This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Shirley Stillinger, a retired social worker. We're going to be talking about the homeless mentally ill. Welcome, Shirley.
Glad to be here.
Good to have you in the studio today. We do have homes, don't we? Roofs over our heads, a studio to record in.
Yes.
But people who are mentally ill sometimes get alienated from families, are on their own, perhaps by choice. How do we know what's going on in their head sometimes? How did you get interested in this particular subject? That wasn't what you'd spent your life, professional life doing.
No, and I'd had experience with homeless as a general category. In my years at a woman's place, my office was in the shelter, so I was familiar, or I knew every woman who came in and something about the circumstances. And in effect, they were all homeless. So I knew about homelessness. I had not really had experience with the mentally ill homeless, I mean, direct personal experience, until, as most people who know me now know, a homeless man began living in my garage.
How did that start?
Well, I hired him to do yard work.
He knocked on your door and said, I'm available?
No, or? Actually, I answered an ad.
Oh.
I needed someone to mow the yard and saw an ad in the paper. Set a time, called him. He made arrangements to come over. And when my doorbell rang, I expected to see a truck in the driveway with yard equipment.
Sure.
There wasn't a truck. There was a bicycle with a cart behind it.
Huh.
It turns out that someone who had befriended him and was leaving the university bought him a bicycle, the cart, and every yard tool you can imagine.
Really?
And
tools. We're talking about hoes and shovels?
Or? And a power mower.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. And a cell phone.
Huh?
So he, and put the ad in the paper for him. So, and since I saw it as he was teaching a man how to fish.
Sure.
But, of course, where does a homeless man keep his tools?
So
they asked if he could keep his equipment in my garage, and I thought that was reasonable.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of it is a little bit like the camel getting his nose under the tent.
Sure.
He began sleeping there. I didn't know it. But then after a while, you know, as I became aware of it, I just didn't have the heart to say, I have this big house all to myself, but you can't even have
a garage.
A garage that was unheated, no electricity, no plumbing, not insulated.
Where did he go to the bathroom? The first question people, I'm sure, are thinking, whether they'd ask it or not.
Generally, the closest gas station.
I see.
Although they didn't like having, the thing that I learned is that people really didn't want him around.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes, partly I think he scared them just by his looks. Sometimes he could have a little wild look in his eye.
Uh-huh.
And he dressed funny. You know, in the summer he'd be wearing long sleeves and a wool hat. When you talked to him, you found out it's because he was worried about West Nile disease.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't want a mosquito bite.
Could communicate reasonably well?
Oh, he talked very well.
Did he?
Very, very good English.
Was he educated?
He sounded more educated than he really was. He was also dyslexic.
I see.
And his mother, with whom I've been in communication, she lives in Texas, but she told me he was diagnosed with dyslexia in third grade.
Oh.
And as you know, not being able to read and write is just a huge handicap.
Yes.
But no, he spoke very well.
When he first started squatting, living in your garage, and you became aware of it and you made the decision to let him stay, what did you worry about? You didn't know him well then. Did you think that perhaps he might be violent? That he might set the place on fire? That...
No. I really didn't worry. The only thing I might have thought about is if whether he would, you know, try to get in the house,
sure,
not to hurt me, but to take something. That never, ever happened, even if I went off and left the house unlocked, or worse, went out the back door and discovered, found out later I'd left the front door open. And, you know, he came and said, "Shirley, I saw your front door was open, and I went and locked it for you."
Really?
Yeah. He was very honest in that, or he is very honest in that sort of way. I might mention that he's now in state prison.
Why is he in prison?
Well, partly it's a string of things. He has had, if you looked at his record, you would see maybe 14 or 15 offenses, all small things. He would... Once stole a $2.50, or he was accused of stealing a $2.50 pair of work gloves from a truck in our neighborhood. He says he didn't do it. And see, it's interesting to me to take up time to press charges, go to court. They were all set for a jury trial on this case. And then at the last minute, the someone, whoever from the state's attorney's office, you know, took a plea. He pled guilty. And I said to him later, "But if you didn't do it, you don't have to say you were guilty." And he said, "Shirley, look at me. Any jury would look at me and find me guilty."
I see.
And I decided he was probably right.
Uh-huh. But might he have been guilty of that or other things for which he was arrested?
I don't know. But most of the things, his last incident was he was charged with extortion. He found a cell phone. There is no suggestion that he stole it. He found it, was able to figure out how to contact the owner, who was a young woman, student at the university, and when he called, and I don't know what he said, he told her he had her phone. He must have said something like, "Would you give me something for it?" And she said, "Well, how much?" And he said, $50. Now, I have to tell you, he had no sense of money. I mean, $40, $100, dollar and a half. I mean, he would just drive me nuts saying, "Oh, but surely all I want is $50. And I'd say, "But $50 is a lot of money." But, you know, he really, I don't know what he said, but she contacted the police, and when he returned her phone, they arrested him.
I see.
In court, his attorney asked her if he had ever threatened her, and she said no. So I still don't understand why he was found guilty of extortion.
Oh. How did he get an attorney? Was that
a public defender?
Public defender,
who has represented him many times. As I say, they've all been. Once he was helping someone take their groceries, an older person take their groceries from the car into the house. He says he asked her if she could if he could have something. I don't know if he did, but he took some things.
I see.
And.
Ordinarily, was his mental condition good enough that he could earn money and buy food he needed?
He could for short periods of time. He received SSI, Supplemental Security Income, of $674, which to people, you know, who grew up in the 30s and 40s, $674 a month seems like a lot of money.
Now, that was because of his mental illness.
Yes. You see, so the government determined that he was not capable of supporting himself. Uh-huh. That's why he got the money.
Sure.
He could work. He did a lot of yard work. And depending at different times with his mental condition, he had more energy than others. He was on medication, overseen by the mental health center.
And did he take his medication?
He tells me he did. You know, I would ask him periodically. I don't know. But you could tell sometimes he really did well.
Did he say himself what his mental illness was?
Oh, yes. Once when he was telling me he didn't like to drink tap water. He only wanted bottled water and a certain brand, just like Monk. wasn't the same brand. And I said to him, you know, we have the best...
Monk is a TV character.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Who has obsessive...
There's only one brand of bottled water he'll drink. I'm a big fan of Monk.
I see.
But I'm telling him, you know, this town has some of the best water in the country.
Sure.
And he said, no. He said, but you know, Shirley, I'm a paranoid schizophrenic. So I said, okay. You know, so he knew what his diagnosis, and he may have played on it.
Now, how did he get to Champaign-Urbana? He said his mother was in Texas. How did he end up here?
He grew up here.
Grew up here.
And, in fact, he learned to play chess, and he told me who taught him, and it was a person.
Someone you knew?
Someone I knew, the age of, you know, one of my children. His mother moved to California when she left here. Okay. And that's where he was when the onset of the schizophrenia, which it's not unusual. He was 18, I think. And generally it's late adolescence, early 20s.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't live at home then. He wanted to be on his own. And he decided to come back here because this is the place he knew.
We're talking with Shirley Stillinger this afternoon on Keeping the Faith about the homeless mentally ill in all of our communities. She's giving an example of someone she got to know well who lived in her garage. If you have a question or comment or would like to share your own experience, this is a live call-in show every Sunday evening from 5 to 6 here on WILL AM 580. Do give us a call. We're eager to have your comments or questions. If it's a local call, punch in 333-9455. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455 will get you in contact with the studio, and the phone will be answered by our engineer, Kyle Croa. She'll put you in line to be talking with our guest, Shirley Stillinger. So those numbers again, 333-9455 or 333-WILL. Or 1-800-222-9455. And that latter number is good for people listening on the internet at will.illinois.edu. And then those who hit AM when they're given the choice of AM, FM, or TV can be listening to this show live. And, of course, it's also podcast. So if you've missed part of the show or you'll miss part later because of other things you have scheduled in your life, you can hear it at your own convenience via your computer by going to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And we spell keeping the faith without that G, so just I-N-K-E-E-P-I-N, keeping the faith.
I could see somebody calling in to say, are you crazy? And I have been asked that. I won't answer that question.
What did your children say? You mentioned you have grown children. What did they say when they discovered you as a single mom, grandmom, living alone, and in your garage you're letting a mentally ill man stay?
Well, one of my children who had not... the one that was the last one to hear about this, and I guess everybody was home, and he found out, and he said, I wasn't there. He said to the others, we can't let Mom do that. And I was told that the other three just stared at him.
How can we control our mother?
Yes. That's right. That's right.
Shirley, we have a call on our toll-free line, line 4, from Logansport, Indiana. Yes, you're on the air with our guest, Shirley Stillinger. Go ahead.
Thank you. I wondered if you could make a comment about the release of the mentally ill that's been going on for some time. Here in Indiana, our governor decided that was one way to save money. And we have an institution outside of Logansport. It's been here for a long, long time. And there were a number of people, mostly schizophrenics, were released to the community. And they occasionally would stand on corners and be talking to somebody. It really upset a lot of people, but And, of course, a lot of them ended up sleeping under bridges and things like that. I've learned, if you can make a comment about that, and just in the social aspect, and certainly about, you know, talk to the people listening to this program regularly, because it's very odious. I find it very odious they did that and continue to do it. Thank you.
No.
Thank you for the comment.
Yes, that's a point I wanted to make. Back in the 70s in Illinois, there was a move to close down the large state mental hospitals, which, and that was done. They're not all closed, but there are very few. The point was made at the time that they would take that money and send it to the communities to provide local care and support to the mentally ill. That did not happen.
The institutions were closed.
Right.
A certain amount of money was saved. Those people were let out, or maybe they weren't closed, but I know
very
the population went. Supposedly anyone who wasn't of immediate danger to someone else or themselves would be released, and that was most of the people.
Right. I remember hearing back in the early 70s, it would just be crowds of people standing on the streets in Chicago with no place to go. And that's and then I was disturbed to see in the paper that there's currently a case in Illinois of, again, demanding that mentally ill people not be put into such wretched places. But then I worry, where are they going to go? Because if nothing else is provided.
Illinois, Indiana are just examples of two states. It seemed to be a movement across the country at that time. As states learned from one another, they could save a lot of money by no longer providing institutionalized care for the severely mentally ill. But as you say, many of the states made the choice to say, well, we'll send some of that money to local institutions. And a little money came to local institutions.
I think so.
But what do you do?
I don't know. And, of course, now in Illinois, when money is so short, it's almost, you feel almost foolish about talking about what needs to be done, although I think we still need to keep that in mind. Our local mental health center does provide services. I think their caseloads must be so high that they really can't put the time in, you know, with an individual. And again, I go to my specific case. You know, he got to see his caseworker maybe every week for 15 minutes or a half an hour. But he needed more than that.
And the law, at least in, I don't know about Indiana's law, but in Illinois, the law is someone has to be threatening someone else before they could be institutionalized.
Right.
And now the tendency is to send them to jail rather than to a mental institution.
Well, that's another problem that I remember former Sheriff Joe Brown telling me that was his biggest headache at our county jail. His correctional staff was not trained to handle mentally ill people. And it's true that the mental health center now does have a worker there. But even that's not enough.
We have another caller waiting from Camargo, Illinois, on line number 4. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead.
Thank you. Ms. Dillinger, I had a question. In the event that I would have a relative, which I do, a great-nephew who clearly has mental health issues. In the instance that a parent or legal guardian won't help him get SSI, can you offer any suggestions how I, as in this case a great uncle, can promote that idea?
Well, of course, is this a minor?
Yes.
Okay.
Right now, a homeless minor.
Uh-huh. Well, there's more you can do there than with an adult because, you know, once somebody's over 18, you have no power. And I don't really know. It depends. Well, let's say you're in Camargo. personally, I think you might even talk to someone at your mental health center to ask them, you know, what's available there and what could you do. Again, everybody is, all state agencies are so cut back. In my day, when I worked in the Department of Children and Family Services many years ago, I could go and take guardianship of a minor who was homeless or, you know, running away. I had, at one point, I had a caseload of 57 runaways.
Oh, my.
And this was back in the early 70s when running away was sort of the thing to do. But see, I don't know if Department of Children and Family Services would get involved now because they're so overworked. But I would suggest talking to
Mental Health Center or Department of Children and Family Services. Those are two places to check.
Right. And their offices, well, not in Camargo, but close to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Good
Appreciate
luck.
It. We're talking with Shirley Stillinger about the homeless mentally ill. She's giving us an example of a man. How old was the man who lived in your garage?
About 40, or maybe late 30s when he started.
How many years was he there?
12.
12 years.
Yes.
So could you ever put your car in there, or did he gradually take it over?
Oh, I couldn't get my car in there anymore. But the deal was then he had to clean the snow off my car.
When you parked in the driveway.
Yeah, and if we had snow.
Uh-huh. And he was mentally acute enough to be able to remember that and do it?
Well,
sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. You know, a point I want to make, though, is he received SSI, Supplemental Security Income, because experts determined he could not support himself. But so here he is, a homeless man. Why would anybody think he's capable of managing all on his own?
Managing his life.
Right. Yeah. You know, he made bad choices frequently. But that's associated with his problems. So,
did he drink or do drugs?
I think he did this most recent episode when he was found guilty of
the extortion over
extortion,
the cell phone.
Thank
yeah.
you. Then he was given probation for a year. Then he went into his probation officer regularly, but they always had him do a drugs test, and he failed it.
I see.
So that automatically lost his probation and then took him to prison for 3.5 years. And that was one, as you know, I wrote a letter to the editor about this. Partly it just seemed to me, if nothing else, a misuse of taxpayers' money to spend $20-something thousand a year.
Supporting him in prison.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's out of proportion, it seems to me.
Uh-huh.
And that's not really, if he could have had some of that money could have been spent to help him find a place to live and to give him some structure. You know, I was not willing to become his daily caseworker.
Sure.
And just,
there was,
I can draw some lines.
There was a certain limit to what you're
yes.
willing to do.
But okay. he really needed and he wanted somebody.
Daily supervision.
Right.
But how could any society afford to provide that for the mentally ill?
I don't know. But I remember once hearing years ago that a society could be judged by the way it cared for its least able people.
Yes.
And I think, I've thought about what would be good for him, and I thought the best I could think of would be like a group home, but where he had his own room and a lock on the door.
Now, would he be willing to go to such a place if it were available?
I think so.
Huh.
He didn't like being in with, see, he didn't, when he, even the times he went to jail, he stayed in his cell. He didn't like to be out with other people.
But he was able to relate to you. Schizophrenics often can't relate to anybody else. They don't sort of know where their own being starts and ends. And
he related, I tell you, if you go around West Urbana, you will find many people who knew him and
employed him
and befriended him and talked to him.
Uh-huh.
He likes to talk.
I see. Surely this program gets downloaded a lot. People want to hear it on via their computer and do searches for topics. And as people see the topic, homeless, mentally ill, they may well listen to this. Let's let them know a little bit about your professional experience so they know who it is that's sharing these observations. Where did you learn how to be a social worker?
Well, that could be another whole subject. I got my master's degree here at the University of Illinois after I'd been home, you know, as a wife and mother for 15 years.
So you raised four children.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
When the youngest got to kindergarten, and I thought, oh, what do I do now? So I went back to school.
And where had you been an undergraduate before that?
University of Texas.
Of Texas. So you're a Texan.
Yes.
Who came to Illinois, got eventually after her family got older, got a MSW, a Master's in Social Work, mm-hmm. at this fine institution here at the University of Illinois. What was your first job?
My first job was for the Department of Children and Family Services.
Working with kids then.
Right. I had, when I decided to go back to school, I wanted to get a scholarship just for tuition. I had the feeling I didn't want my work to take from the family's work. And I started applying. The first place I applied, I think the first place I applied was the university.
Uh-huh.
And they said I wasn't eligible because I was too old.
I
was 36. And I meekly said, oh, okay. That wouldn't happen now.
Today, but, yeah.
Well, of course, the law's been changed. So then I applied to the National Institute of Mental Health.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out their scholarships were supervised by the University of Illinois, and their rules applied, so I was too old. So then I went to the Department of Children and Family Services, who welcomed me with open arms. And
you said 36 is just right.
Yeah. Well, and it was a time when the department was expanding and giving out a lot of master's scholarships. I had a commitment then to work a month and a half for each month of school they paid me for.
So if they paid you to go to school, paid your tuition,
mm-hmm.
then you had a commitment to them to work so many years eventually.
So, I was so, I don't know, sheltered, naive. I didn't even know what social work was when I went to school. I really didn't know anything about child welfare.
And you didn't know how low the pay would be.
Well, when you've been home, at the time, $12,000 a year seemed really good.
Did it?
Uh-huh. It did, and full health benefits.
Okay.
And you go from nothing to $12,000, you know, it was like, wow.
Sure.
But I found my love really was child welfare.
Uh-huh.
It seemed to me everything in the world was child welfare. Uh-huh. I mean, whether there were potholes in the streets or good telephone service, and all sorts of other things were really child welfare.
Uh-huh.
And then I was lured from there to Cunningham Children's Home, where I worked for 7 years.
So how long were you at DCFS?
Seven.
7 years there.
Seven's magic number.
And then seven at mm-hmm. the Cunningham Children's Home.
And then I had
That's a Methodist church-sponsored
Methodist
agency.
Women.
The women of the Methodist
Church. It's owned by the United Methodist Women.
Okay.
And that's important.
In the state of Illinois?
Yes.
Okay.
Their district runs from Iowa to Indiana across central Illinois, this district of United Methodist Women.
And you were there 7 years doing what?
I was director of social services, which meant I supervised the caseworker and the nurse. And for a while, I had a caseload of the girls who were at the group home.
Okay.
And it was a wonderful a wonderful experience.
So you've worked both for a public agency, mm-hmm. DCFS, and for a private right. church-related one. What were the differences?
Well, they prayed at Cunningham at open staff meetings, which I didn't object to because it was a Methodist facility. And
although you yourself were not particularly religious in that way?
Exactly. Except, as I told one person, I did grow up in the Methodist church and I knew how to talk Methodist.
Okay.
So, you know, it was a good fit. Also, a lot of flexibility. So it was, you know, you could try different things. You could do different combinations of working with kids. And in those days, it was really a home. You know, kids would, when school is out, kids would stop by and say hello and talk about how their day in school was. The very relaxed kind of place. So, but then I went on to, well, for a year even, I was up at Hewling Home in Rantoul. We were going to start a therapeutics residential institution for children.
This was something you helped start?
No, I was hired by Beacon Therapeutic School in Chicago to start it. But, I mean, I wasn't just off on my own. And that's, we can skip over that part. That didn't go well. So I was unemployed and saw the ad in the paper for director at a woman's fund, which I had helped start back in 70, 71.
Just as a volunteer?
Right, right. And then it looked to me like that was fate.
Tell people about a woman's fund.
Well, originally we just called it a woman's place, and it was a shelter for women and their children, which at the time was unique. Usually if women needed to go someplace, they had to leave their children. When we started it, we didn't know what women would come for shelter for, but we soon found out that it was domestic violence.
And so a woman's place continues as a place for women suffering from abuse.
Yes.
We have another caller on line 4. We're talking with Shirley Stillinger about the homeless mentally ill. And line 4 from Pontiac, Illinois. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. My name is Margo, and I feel like I know you because I have a son who is at Cunningham.
Oh.
He's now 22. He is mentally ill. He receives SSI, and sometimes his room looks like a garage.
Yes.
But I'm calling to sort of just connect with you and tell you thank you for your caring for the gentleman and giving him a space, because there really doesn't seem to be much here in Illinois to really help the mentally ill. I've been connected with the mental health institutions here, what's offered to help my son. But he doesn't work, and like you say, he's 22 and doesn't have much of a drive. His diagnosis is, what is it? It's a lot of things. It's anxiety disorder. Mm. It's a mood disorder and bipolar. And we've gone through so much. But I don't really have any suggestions or any main questions. I just want to let you know I'm thankful for the compassion you have for helping.
Well, thank you. You know, the troublesome things, I'll have to say there are times that I've been so angry at this man that I didn't want anybody around to hear me because I was not kind. But then most of the time I'd think, you know, where in our society is there a place?
Mm-hmm.
What is he supposed to do? Where can he go?
Exactly. We're to the point where I wouldn't trust my son if I had a business where there's money, you know. Mm. But he doesn't have any drive whatsoever. Ours is a case where the birth mother had used alcohol and cocaine.
Oh.
And so... I don't see him getting much better than where he is right now at 22.
Right.
But trying to explain that to the world is quite another matter. I find myself getting pretty angry at the world in general.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But because at least, and I have to remind myself again and again that he is 22, so I have to let him have some freedom, but he can't destroy my home.
Right.
You know, it gets tricky.
Well, and it's hard for family. I'll have to say with the man I'm talking about, I wondered sometimes, why is family, you know, why is he here on his own? Mm-hmm. But then I met his parents. His mother came by from out, she was in town, and she came by and thanked me. Mm-hmm. She had not been able, she said, you know, she couldn't make him stay at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd be out at night and... What he liked to do, and of course this is, makes him unpopular, he would go out at 1 when the bars close and panhandle.
Oh, dear.
Well, he knew that students coming out of bars at mm-hmm. 1 or 2 in the morning were feeling good, and he didn't even have to ask people. He just sat on the ground with his hand out, mm-hmm. and he almost looked at that as a job.
Well, yeah, that's sort of how my son is. So I have to keep an eye on stuff now. At 22, I count out his medicine every time I get it, make sure, because there was one instance where someone's missing, and of course I wasn't going to get a straight answer.
You're right.
So, but I'm not sure how anybody goes about this, especially in my case with a son who, you know, I mean, his father stepped away from this long time ago. It's just hard for people. Because I think, don't you think a lot of it is because there doesn't seem to be a happy ending here. I think a lot of people just have a hard time because we're used to having, oh, things are better and better, you know.
Well, that's true. It's also that I think our society wants people to fit in some spot.
Absolutely.
You know, we square holes and round pegs sort of thing. And then people don't.
Mm-hmm. No, they don't.
Fit in. There's no place else for them to go.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at now if when I pass on what my son is going to do. And I'm thinking, gosh, I hope there's somebody like you who can give him a garage if he needs one.
Well, you know, I've been surprised how many people I know in this town who, as they've gotten, have children with schizophrenia. And then as they've gotten older, that's exactly, they worry what's going to happen.
Oh, I know.
When I'm not here as a backup.
Yeah.
And that's a serious concern.
But my life has been put on hold pretty much. I mean, I work so that I can be home by 3-ish. So, but even then, I walk in. I never know what's gonna be here.
Well, now you know, and I don't know if you're aware. And I there are groups of parents of schizophrenic children who have organized
supportive parents of the mentally ill.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm connected with now.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I think I'm about as connected with as much support as I can get.
Yeah. No, really when it gets down to it, it's just, you're there.
Yeah. Yeah, without prayer and a strong faith, it would have been pretty tough.
Well.
Because that's really what sustains me. I remind myself that I'm serving Christ in all this because the suffering servant consciousness, you know. That this is somebody who I'm called to, you know, to answer to.
Yes. Well, I will tell you, I can really and truly say I do understand now with the experience I've had.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I just wish you well.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for voicing things. And I really do think a lot of credit also needs to be given to NAMI.
Yes.
For what they offer families and mentally ill.
Yes.
What,
and NAMI is?
The National Association for the Mentally Ill.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. So, well, I guess that was all. But
yes.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for calling.
This show and everything. So,
appreciate thanks. The comments. Thank you. Let's go to line number 1 in Champaign. Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm going to say hello to Steve and Shirley, and I'm a pastor in town on campus and wanted to, you know who I am?
Yes.
I wanted to thank Shirley for all the love that and care you've given our mutual friend of, I think I've known this gentleman myself for coming up 20 plus years.
Yes.
And very, very dear to me. And our church, in fact, did a kind of a letter signing campaign,
yes,
trying to help him get just a sense of justice in our system.
What church is that?
Community United Church of Christ.
Thank you.
Right on 6th and Daniel. I'm the campus minister there. You know, all these years I've heard about the statistics of criminalizing certain people's certain coping mechanisms, if it's drug abuse, mm-hmm, or is the one I'm particularly thinking about. And it's never been so real to me as someone who's, say, a dear friend, if you might say, gentleman who's been living in Shirley's garage until journeying with him and seeing that one of the ways he's tried to cope with his mental illness challenges is on occasionally maybe making a bad choice that then has become criminalized. And that has just given me some sleepless nights.
And, yes.
Yeah. And so I wanted to thank you.
Well, thank
you for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Go ahead, Carol.
Well, I was going to say, that's part of the reason that I talk about this a lot is that I think most people, you can read statistics, and they just don't have the impact as when you deal with one person and you see the effect. You know, I can extrapolate from his case. I did some looking at statistics and figured out that there are probably, let me see, 72 homeless, mentally ill people in Champaign County. I won't take time to give you where I get those numbers, but taking a percentage of the homeless, nationally they figure 20 to 25% of the homeless are mentally ill. But we don't see them, and we don't really to experience what it's like to be them. I get very upset with him, and then I feel amazement sometimes that he has the courage to get up in the morning. So,
we have another caller, actually a couple callers waiting. Well, let's go to line number two in Champaign. Yes, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Shirley, I'm fairly familiar with Generations of Hope. It was Hope for the Children,
oh, right,
initially in Rantoul, Illinois.
Right.
And that program, it's intergenerational, has been really quite successful in having active retirees who are now 16 years, mm-hmm, since it started, becoming more frail. But they have been very successful in helping, started out with young children who had many serious problems because of spending time in foster care. And now some of those kids and the families and other seniors are helping the more frail. So it's really become a circle of care and quite fascinating to watch. But I'm wondering what you think about that concept for helping these homeless mentally ill, creating a community where I believe, although I'm not as familiar with this particular topic, that there are boomers retiring who would, with all the benefits of that kind of a community, would love to be able to give back and have that be a purpose in their lives.
Well, that's an interesting thought. Yes, I am familiar with that, and was because of my experience with DCFS.
Right, DCFS and Cunningham.
Right, but I felt I was not a big fan of foster care, because but what they've been able to do up there.
Those kids do get adopted. I mean,
well, but it's also that there's this wider range of support.
Absolutely,
and that's what I always found was missing with just ordinary foster care.
Right,
it's an interesting idea to think about it for the adult mentally ill.
Caller, for people who aren't familiar with Generations of Hope in Rantoul, could you describe it in just a couple sentences?
Maybe you'd like to do that.
Well, it's an intergenerational neighborhood. It was started 16 years ago on about 20 acres of what was the Chanute Air Force Base. And it's intergenerational. There's about 40 households of seniors who get reduced rent for giving 6 hours a week of volunteer time to support the children and families. There are about 12 families up there at any one time who agree to adopt up to 4 children from the foster care system, and then they can raise those children in that intergenerational community or move away at some point if they, you know, so choose to do so.
Thank you. Very helpful.
The thing about that model for the adult mentally mm-hmm. ill is that I've learned with this one experience.
Right.
He really needs to be free. He needs to feel that he's free. I mean, the problem he had even at the men's shelter when it was at McKinley, mm-hmm. you know, he wanted to eat his cereal on the steps outside.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't allowed. It's... No, well, McKinley was the best of them. He can't go to the time shelter because he still panhandles, and they know that, and that's against their rules. But I could see if you had people that really understood.
That's right.
And could be flexible, that, as I said, a sort of a group home arrangement for
right.
people like this. That
yeah. It certainly wouldn't be for everybody, but I no. just think that there would be people who are retiring, who have had experience, you've had experience, you know, the previous callers have mm-hmm. had experience, relatives of you and others, you know something about this.
But you still need funding, and you need...
Absolutely.
You need support, which means an agency at some point needs to be involved and needs to be committed. And again, I feel silly talking about money since we don't even have money in the state to do the bare necessities. But as a long-term goal, that's the sort of model that I would look for adults like this.
Well, I think it's interesting. I think your point about one person, what did you say, the young man you're involved with is what, we're spending $27,000?
Yes.
You know, I mean, we make those arguments, and it does take people. What I think it takes is people really, really committed and bringing those
yes.
people together and finding the leadership to make it happen. But
what I've found and so made me so angry the day I was in court and saw him put in handcuffs and taken away is that, again, our society is willing to spend money to build new prisons and to hire more guards and to do all sorts of things for law enforcement and punishment, but we're not willing to spend that or anywhere near that amount of money earlier in the day
no,
for
I...
prevention. And it's distressing.
Yes, I totally agree. I totally agree.
Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate your comments. We have another caller waiting. That's line number 3, a caller in Urbana. You're on the air with Shirley Stillinger on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. Shirley probably doesn't remember me, but in the 70s, I was a young professional and really looked up to Shirley to get some ideas on how to advocate. But I want to thank you for that, Shirley.
Oh. You're more than welcome.
Thanks. What I really want to say is that in support of what Shirley's been saying and your frustration, I had the unfortunate experience of having my 6-year-old child killed
oh.
by a person who was not treated for his schizophrenia.
Oh, boy.
And it's been a long time ago, and so I can talk about it. But that person eventually got, after a trial, was found not guilty for reason of insanity. But no support was given to the young man. No help. No nothing. And I think that's all part of what you're saying about how our fearless leaders have decided to use the funding in other ways, instead of supporting not only programs, but families.
Yes, yes.
The woman who called earlier, bless her heart, who has a 22-year-old son,
right.
is going to make sure. She's going to do everything she can for her son, and that is just terrific. But we're up against, you know, you're up against the stigma the people don't want them around. And I just want to say I'm just so impressed that you supported in your own way that man for so many years.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry about your child. And I admire you for being interested in the culprit, but punishment is not at that point for that person was not really going to make any difference. But if he could have had support to correct,
that's right. You
know, they call it the Illinois Department of Corrections, but there's no correcting done.
That's right. And there's no there's no acceptance. You know, I don't think that sending that particular man to prison would have helped unless there was going to be some mental health service,
right,
you know, at the prison. And I don't know whether that would have happened or not. But, you know, the people with mental illness, in my experience, are really not acceptable in most of our society. You know, they're really, the people don't want them. And that's the sad thing, because they just have a disability, like many other people have a disability.
And it's something that they need help with. They can't help. You know, a lot of times I think people look at a mentally ill person and think, well, why doesn't he just get a job? Why doesn't he clean up? Why, you know, all of these other things.
Why doesn't he behave?
Yes. But you're right. It is a disability, and it's beyond their control without, you know, medication or counseling or just support.
Right.
Well, thank you for calling.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you again. We're getting close to our end time, Shirley. In the Champaign-Urbana area, let's talk locally since mm-hmm. you've given us a local example. Some people have said that there are more agency support for homeless males, whether mentally ill or drug addicted or simply stuck in poverty, than there is for females. Is that your experience with having been the director of a woman's fund?
Yes. More often, women are able maybe to move in with a family or sleep on somebody's sofa. Doesn't mean there aren't homeless women out there. And that was my incentive when we started Homestead Corporation, which is an agency that promotes and provides housing, decent, affordable housing for the lowest income people. And our first...
And that's here in Champaign-Urbana.
Yes. And we have an apartment building in Urbana. The only requirement to get on the waiting list is that you are homeless. And the reason I got involved was that I saw women leaving the shelter. And if they didn't have children, if they had children, they could apply for public housing. If they didn't have children, there was no place to go. And
often family wouldn't take them.
Or they had their own problems.
Sure.
And more often I saw women go back to their abusive partner because they didn't have any place else to go. So, and I believe, I'm not sure right now, that at our apartment building, it's the efficiency apartments. And they're pretty much about half and half men and women. And we have a year-long, it takes, the person who just got in had been on the list for a year.
For a year.
Yeah.
How is Homestead Corporation funded?
Well, to get it built was the interesting thing because we had a HUD grant that could only be used for rehabbing, not to new construction. And you may have been aware at the time, we got a building from Chanute, a big our officer barracks, I believe they were, and cut the building in three pieces and brought it down to Urbana, put it back together. And if you saw it now, you would never know.
Would not know.
That's
yeah.
what it was.
It's an attractive-looking building.
Yes.
Of course, I remember the neighbors were concerned when the Homestead Corporation wanted to put homeless people in that part of Urbana.
Yes, they thought that it was going to create a crowd of homeless people around it, but and actually one of the people in the neighborhood did speak up and say they were wrong. You know, we keep the building up in the grass mode, and it's in good shape.
We're out of time.
Yes.
I'm Steve Shoemaker. We've been talking with Shirley Stillinger, a retired social worker who's on the board of a number of things, the trustee of the University YMCA, board of the Homestead Foundation, League of Women Voters, ACLU. She was on CASA for 13 years. She's been a volunteer at Will. We've been delighted to have her share her experience with providing a place for a homeless man who sadly now is in prison. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Earth, sky.
Salmonella is the bacteria that causes food poisoning. Yale University researcher Jorge Galan has spent over two decades trying to figure out how salmonella attacks our bodies and makes us sick. In the journal Science in early 2011, Dr. Galan revealed his discovery of the mechanism by which salmonella hijacks our intestines, cell by cell.
He has this remarkable device, which for all intents and purposes is like a nano syringe.
A nano syringe, he's saying. A syringe of a very tiny size. In a matter of seconds, a salmonella bacteria can attach to a healthy intestinal cell and launch an attack by injecting a bunch of proteins with its microscopic syringe.
It needs to send these proteins in a very precise order. So in other words, imagine that the syringe needs to inject protein A, protein B, protein C, protein D. The question is, how do you establish that order?
Galan said that individual salmonella bacteria are like delivery trucks. In a delivery truck, packages are often placed according to when and where they need to be delivered. Same thing with the attack proteins inside of a tiny salmonella cell. Dr. Galan said that if a drug can simply mess with salmonella's ability to order its proteins, that drug can stop salmonella in its tracks. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
I'm Diane Adams. My friends call me Dee Dee. I was born blind. My husband worked with visually impaired older folks. He would talk about the radio reader. He'd say, I ordered this radio reader for so-and-so, and so one day I said, I would really love to have one of those.
At the Illinois Radio Reader, local newspapers, books, and magazines, and periodicals are read and recorded by over 70 volunteers, and then those programs are broadcast to those visually impaired people who have our radios in their homes.
It is literally our newspaper. I feel we as visually impaired people are so privileged to have a service like this. I'm Dee Dee Adams from Decatur, and WILL is my source for the Illinois Radio Reader.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
From WBEC.